Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem AMA, the fun size show where you can ask me anything. Producer Joe Russo, this is a special show today.
It is a special show because we are continuing Mick Garris Appreciation Month by celebrating the 30th anniversary of your first Stephen King collaboration, Sleepwalkers.
Stephen King's Sleepwalkers is 30 years old, and that's really hard to believe, because aren't I only 33 or something? Yeah, I don't know.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it is a milestone. And that being said, we went to our fans and they gave us lots of great questions. And we're going to do it in a similar format to what we just did with The Shining. So we're going to kind of just walk through the process of making the movie chronologically, and I'll ask some of the fans questions as we go.
And, okay, great. It was really great way to revisit The Shining for me. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, it was. We got some wonderful feedback on that episode, and I'm really glad people enjoyed it. So we're going to try to do it again. So are you ready?
It's good. Yeah.
Are you ready to go back into the Wayback Machine?
Let's do it.
All right. So let's start with where you kind of were at right before this all went down. You had Critters 2 and Psycho 4 under your belt.
Right.
What's life like for Mick Garris in the early 1990s? Were you developing original projects? Were you pitching out open directing assignments?
I was doing screenwriting work for various studios. I had now directed two movies. So that put me into a new world beyond the screenwriting world and beyond the television world, even though Psycho 4 was officially a TV movie for Showtime, it was theatrical overseas. So I was getting various things sent to me. And one of the queries came from Columbia Studios. They had Stephen King's Sleepwalkers, his first original screenplay, not based on any IP, any previously written stories or novels or anything like that. This was an original screenplay.
That's right. If you're going to go look for the book, you're never going to find it.
Exactly. So they talked to my agent and they set up a meeting with me, and the meeting went great. They were looking for a writer-director, so there was somebody that they could have on board who could help King and the studio kind of liaise between the studio and King in any necessary revisions that they felt were required for the script before it got into production. So we had this great first meeting. They said, you know, you've got this job. Tomorrow we have to meet with another director who we have a really close relationship with his agent. So it's just a meeting we have to do. And so tomorrow they had that meeting with that director, and they gave him the job. So
you gotta love Hollywood.
Yeah. So they gave him the job, and I went on to greener pastures. And then after a couple months later, I got a call that they wanted to have another meeting with me. And I went to lunch with the production executive, Teddy Z, and with Dick Stenta, the line producer on the film. And it was a very odd lunch. They told me that the previous director was rewriting the script and taking it far away from Stephen King's script. So there's no way they'd be able to call it Stephen King's Sleepwalkers in the title. And he had created a planet of sleepwalkers and all kinds of things that had nothing to do with what King had done.
Right.
And so we're talking, and then it was at a lunch meeting. And as we finish lunch, Dick Stenta, the line producer, says, "Here, let's take you to your office." And it's like, oh,
you're like,
I had no idea they were. Yeah. I had no idea they were hiring me. And I started work that day.
Well, so, all right. I want to dig into a couple little things here and there. The first meeting before they hired the other guy, did you read the script before going into that meeting?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And I'm curious, and as was our friend of the podcast and director himself, Dave Parker, asked, did they warn you about some of the subject matter before you read it, or did you just read it clean?
They did not warn me about it, but I read it clean. But I knew Stephen King's work really well.
Right.
And right. I had just a year or two before made Psycho 4, which is one of the reasons I believe I was hired to do this movie.
Right.
Dealing with incest and mother-son relations.
You were the natural fit.
Yeah, don't tell my mom. Good thing she's no longer with us. But so it worked out that way. But King had director approval. Right. So they had sent him Psycho 4, and this other director had made a highly regarded television movie. Mm. And he saw both of those, and then he went, wow, I had no idea. I did not expect Psycho 4 to be any good. And he really liked Psycho 4. And thematically, it just so happened to dovetail perfectly with Sleepwalkers. So I didn't know anything about it till I'd read it. But they knew I was very knowledgeable about King's work, that I'd read everything he'd written. And they felt it was a good match, despite up until Psycho 4, everything I'd done had been very family friendly.
Emblem-esque, yeah.
Yeah, very much in the world of Spielberg and Critters 2. And
which, to be fair, Sleepwalkers does have that kind of Norman Rockwell goes to hell that you enjoy so much.
That is my favorite theme, and I've worked with it several times. But it was, and it is definitely a family film for a very different kind of family.
But yeah. But this was also wasn't your first blush pitching on a Stephen King property, because I remember you had told me you read Pet Sematary a couple of years prior to this too.
Yeah, when they made Pet Sematary, that was my first interview with a major studio regarding directing, because I had done Amazing Stories, but I had not directed anything feature length yet.
Right.
And the executive was somebody I had worked with. She'd been an executive at Avco Embassy when I was doing specialized publicity there on The Fog and Escape from New York and The Howling. And she graduated to being an executive at Paramount. So I met with them, and that script for Pet Sematary was a fantastic script. And I was really enthusiastic about it. And King had done the adaptation himself. And if you can track it down and read it, it's a really good, riveting screenplay. And so I had a meeting on it, but I think the fact that I'd never directed a movie before had a lot to do with me not doing it. Plus, they got Mary Lambert to do it hot off of doing her Madonna videos.
It's a bona fide classic in its own right. So yeah. And history worked out just fine for you in the King business. But it did kind of put a maybe it bugging you that, like, I want to do a Stephen King movie. Like, was that a goal? Was that an ambition at the time for Mick Garris?
It wasn't a goal or an ambition, but who wouldn't jump at the chance to work with Stephen King? And obviously he was my favorite author, especially within the genre. And the opportunity to work on that, I thought that was way out of my reach. And the way it got into my reach was that it was a very low budget studio movie. It was a studio movie, yes, but it was a $15 million movie, which on a studio level is kind of an equivalency to the $4 million Critters 2 in an independent level.
And on in today's money it would be a very healthy budget for a studio movie. So, you know. Well,
a very unhealthy budget for a studio movie.
Well, no, I mean, well, 15 in today's dollars is probably closer to 25, and they just don't make movies in that range anymore.
Exactly.
I guess is more the what I'm saying. There, it's like 10 and below and then 100 and above, you know?
Yeah, or it's like $200,000 or $200 million, not much in between.
It's sad but true. So when you went in for that first meeting with them on the project, you read the script. Did you put together a pitch? Like, how did you go in? How did you tackle trying to get the job?
Well, back in the early 90s, people didn't do pitch decks. They just talked about it. They talked about how they would handle it. What were the important elements to it? Which are the scenes that demanded the most attention? How would you cast it? What were your ideas about pictorializing something that's on the page in a very specific way? Mm-hmm. And so I was able to have a conversation with the creative executives there, and it went really well. They felt that I understood Stephen King maybe more than they did. And in reality, it's not a maybe, but but it was a very good, very collaborative conversation, and the meeting was quite collegial, and everything went really well. And it seemed to be too easy. And
yeah,
indeed it was for a while.
It is pretty funny how you can have those meetings with studio execs and you think they went your way, and then you'll find out a couple of days later, well, no, maybe not, you know.
Yeah, we hired the other guy. Well, yeah. Wait, uh-huh. But you said, yeah, I'm gonna tell mom.
I just went through that on a remake property recently myself. So,
oh dear, I'm sorry.
Oh, you know, that's how it goes, right? So maybe they'll come knocking at my door a few months from now. You never know.
That's right. If they do a planet of whatever it is. And
yeah. And you can probably guess that's a possibility. So, all right. They called you back in, you met them for lunch. You didn't realize going in, it was an interview really, right? It was more just, you thought you were taking a meeting with them, or?
I thought I was taking a meeting about Sleepwalkers.
Yeah.
I knew that that relationship had soured with the other director. And so I thought it was going to be another tap dance, you know,
dance
monkey for the executives. but I had already done that dance, and they invited me into the finals. And so
really they walked you from the Sony commissary to a bungalow, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And off it, on the lot. It was pretty phenomenal.
That's incredible. So you're thrown into the wolves essentially, right? Yeah. You know, you're in this machine that's already moving. What do you do? What's your first order of business?
Well, the first thing you do is get together with the line producer, get together with the casting director, talk to Stephen King on the phone, and just, you hit the ground running. Pre-production started that day.
Wow.
So, you know, there are a lot of people involved. I didn't bring in many of the keys that was brought together by the studio and by Dick Stenta, who was a very old school screaming type New York producer, we had our differences here and there.
I couldn't think of a personality to be better matched with yours.
Yeah, exactly. But I did bring in Rodney Charters, who was my DP on Psycho 4. And I brought in Nicholas Pike to do the score, and I was able to bring in some key people gave me comfort to deal with. But I was fortunate in being assigned some really, really terrific crew members to make this movie. And we were making it in town. And in those days, I only worked in LA. And I thought, God, it'd be so much fun to go on location someday. And those words came back to haunt me.
you never went back.
Yeah.
So you get the job, you get thrown into the fire. you had your, I imagine this is your first conversation with Stephen King ever, right?
Yeah. It was the very first time, was on the phone. And then there were issues where the studio had some thoughts about notes. And I would call him and say, here's something they feel needs to be addressed. Do you want me to do it? And he would say, no, give me till tomorrow. And then the next morning I'd come into the studio and in the fax machine, there would be six new pages.
What's a fax machine? That's
I know. Only the fax, man.
Yeah.
But, and there were these great pages. And so the script was the first thing that needed addressing because it had been dismantled by this previous director.
Right.
My job was to put the Stephen King back in the script and handle anything, any discrepancies or things that they felt needed adjustment.
Was that a tap dance you were nervous about, considering you knew that the last director went off the rails with them? Like,
no, I was confident about it because he had done that and I really liked what King had done.
Right, right.
And I felt that even if King didn't want to do the heavy lifting, that I was capable of restoring it in the same manner in which he had approached it. But most of the revisions he did, I wrote the scene with the sleepwalkers in front of the mirror that almost got us an NC-17.
Which we're going to talk about.
I know we'll get into that. And there were a couple of other things, but it was getting the ship in the script in shape first and then assembling a great crew. And, you know, once your feet hit the concrete, it's a sprint all the way until you finish shooting. So there's so much work to do in pre-production that you barely notice when you start production.
Yeah. Well, which is a great way to kind of segue into some pre-production questions. One thing I'm curious about, because obviously it was, like we said, it was already moving when you got hired, but you said in the past that the Columbia studio had, I think it was Frank Price
was the head of the studio at the time.
He said he didn't want to make a movie that involved incest, and then he was out.
Yeah, what he said was, as long as I'm head of this studio, we're not making a movie where a mother has sex with her son. So halfway into production, he was proven right when Mark Canton came in and replaced him.
Yeah.
Mark didn't have nearly the same scruples. No, I'm kidding, Mark. Mark was one of the producers on Nightmare Cinema and was a really great partner on that project.
He was, and Mark was a little bit of a maverick. He was a little bit more of a risk taker.
Definitely.
But when in the production process did that happen? Like, was he hoping that Stephen King would just change his mind as you would get closer and closer and closer to shooting? Or like how long did that shadow last over the project?
We were shooting when it happened. So we were facing the very real possibility that we might have to cut around that sequence.
Oh my gosh.
And that was obviously a central element of the story. And to only describe it and not show it and not have it take place would have been incredibly cheesy and quite a cheat. And so, we just went along as if we were going to make the movie our way. We had the 800-pound gorilla of Stephen King on our side. So nobody expected Frank Price to get the boot. But when he did, there was a collective sigh of relief, as you might imagine.
I can't imagine. That's pretty amazing. That is fate stepping in.
It did indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
On furry little paws. Yeah.
One last kind of, I guess, screenplay question. So the Sleepwalkers mythology, it's interesting. It's kind of vampire like,
right?
There's definitely have powers beyond what we know vampires to have. How did you and King kind of hammer down what they could do, what they couldn't do?
Well, it was never explained. And the events of the script took place and you saw how one would suck the life of a virgin and transfer it to the mother character. Right. So because it was so obtuse about that, intentionally, I came up with the idea of doing the credit sequence the way we did, showing it going back to ancient Egypt and these artifacts and hieroglyphics and all of that. But I also invented the Chillicothe Encyclopedia of Arcane Knowledge. I made that up. And yeah, people think it's a real book because it's like 1861 or something. It's got a quote describing what sleepwalkers were in mythology. And that's all bullshit that I made up. And then polished it a little. Yeah.
But it does, it's bullshit that adds a lot of context. And a lot, I think as a viewer, some needed context.
Yeah, it was needed, which is why I put it into the title sequence. So you weren't going in there completely barefisted. Yeah.
And I also think you, by tying them to ancient Egypt, you gave it a really interesting backstory, you know?
Oh yeah, the cat and Egyptian mythology, there's a lot of it there.
Yeah. So David writes, there are strong echoes of themes from Beowulf and other classics in this movie, Grendel and his mother, for example. Do you think Stephen developed this film with those classics in mind?
You know, we never talked about anything nearly so highfalutin.
Yeah.
It may well be that inspired him, but what I think was he wanted to do an original story directly for the screen, and that was kind of transgressive. Mm-hmm. Wanted to do something that hadn't been done before. And to this day, there are not many movies like Sleepwalkers.
No, it is wholly unto itself in all the best ways.
Well, hopefully so. I am sure in ways that other people would not.
Hey, 30 years later, people love it. It is for sure a cult favorite. So, all right, let's talk casting. It's always a puzzle. And obviously Brian Krause has the challenge of not only having chemistry with Machen Emmick, but also Alice Krieger. Right. So who do you cast first?
Well, the most important person to cast was Alice, because the world revolved around her. And so we had met with a lot of people, from Mimi Rogers to Celia Ward to a number of really fine actresses for that part.
Julia Roberts, is there any context to that?
Well, there may be context to it, but there's no truth to it whatsoever.
Okay.
No one ever mentioned Julia Roberts as playing the mother in Sleepwalkers. Would have been weird.
Weird.
22 years old at the time.
Hey, I'm just reading what's on IMDb. All right.
Yeah, so believe everything you read, but
that's true. I think we might stamp out another IMDb legend too later, but
we'll get into it.
So casting Alice Krieger.
So Alice had made a huge impression on me in Ghost Story.
Right.
She was so beautiful and alluring, and also a level of intelligence that she brings to everything she does. And she was obviously comfortable with nudity, which there wasn't much of, but did come into play. But there's also a strangeness about her. Her eyes are mysterious and mystical and captivating. And this inherent oddness that she's an incredibly sweet lady. And
yeah, she is. We've had her on the show.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, she's so talented and terrific and all, but there is definitely a very mysterious quality to her. And the idea of this feline creature, she was so good at being in touch with her inner cat that it became pretty clear early on that she was the odds on favorite. We met with people, we read other people, including Bo Derek, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
So that was a meeting, not a reading. Yeah, her agent was kind of a legend in the agency business. He was like 90 years old at the time and brought her in. And that was an amazing meeting with Bo Derek.
Oh my gosh, I bet.
but Alice, really, there's such a sense of refinement, and you believe that she's been on the planet for 1,000 years, you know, constantly evolving, and her knowledge and sense of intelligence and worldview was so strong in her. And there's this erotic quality that she had to have in making that character sexual without it being salacious.
Yeah. And I think you guys walked that line.
Yeah.
Tell me about casting Majden and Brian.
Okay. Brian, they suggested, the studio suggested Brian because he had made Return to the Blue Lagoon and was one of the last people who was put under contract to a studio.
Oh,
he
wow.
was under a studio contract with Columbia. And so this helped pay off that contract, but he was also the right guy. I found that, especially at that time, much more difficult to cast young men than young women. It seemed like, especially then, young guys were in it to get laid, and young women were in it more for the artistry of it, for the acting chops and all of that.
Yeah.
So we went through meeting a lot of young men, and Brian really was gung-ho, and he was really into it. And Machen, of course, her major claim to fame at that time was Twin Peaks.
Right.
And I had only seen Twin Peaks a couple of times, so I had not been as familiar with her work. But once we met her, once she met with Brian, we had them together. There was obviously really great chemistry with them. They were both incredibly good people to work with, as was Alice, really collaborative, really up for everything. And so that triumvirate really worked out well.
Is it true that both Machen and you are allergic to cats?
Well, I am, or I was. I think you're right. I think Machen is also. I've gotten over it over the years.
Yeah.
But at that time, yeah, I was still allergic to cats.
Oh my gosh. How hard was that to deal with during production?
Not very. It wouldn't be bad. I would actually hold Sparks, the cat who played Clovis, and without any problems. An amazing cat. And I know there's a question about that.
Oh, of course there are. Yes.
But most of the cat work was not face to face. A lot of it was second unit, where we had 126 cats who were
right.
And I wasn't cuddling with them or holding them in my arms. And really,
Machen
only did at the ending of the movie.
That's right. And did you load her up with, Benadryl, or like, how did she get through
it? She didn't tell me. She never told me until well after the fact that she was allergic to cats.
You know, what's funny is I had a similar exchange with the lead of the Au Pair. She didn't know how to swim, and she didn't tell me until the day we had to put her in a pool. funny how they'll do that when they need a role.
Exactly. Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, I can hold a cat. Sure.
I'm good at riding horses.
Yeah exactly. All right, let's run through some of the other actors in the movie, because there are some really memorable people who pop up.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the cameos in a bit, but let's just talk about some of the cast. Tell me about casting Mark Hamill.
Well, that was the opening scene and the ending scene in the movie are reshoots. So they were not originally part of the production schedule. So that was done after the fact. I knew Mark from when I was doing Star Wars reception work.
Wow.
So we were friendly at that time. And I just wondered, I wonder if we could get Mark to do this. And I called him up.
Yeah.
And I asked if he'd be interested. And he said, that sounds like a lot of fun. So he was there for 2 days, I think.
Tell me about the mustache.
The mustache was his idea. And I've had that before, not before this show, but on the judge, Chris Noth, who is famously clean-faced, insisted on a mustache for his part. But because Mark Hamill was doing it uncredited, he wanted to wear the mustache just to change his appearance, because it didn't rely on him being the star of the movie. It was just a surprise treat for the fans, and it was fun for him to do. And I'm forever grateful that he agreed to be a part of it.
Yeah. It is a really fun way to open the movie, for sure. Yeah. How about Lyman Ward and Cindy Pickett?
Well, once we had one, we knew we wanted the other because they were
Ferris. They were married at the time, right?
They were married at the time. They were Ferris Bueller's parents.
Yep.
And they made a good team, and they really fit that mom and dad in Norman Rockwell's Middle America.
Yeah.
Really sweet and loving and suburban and all of that. And at the time, Cindy was pregnant with their child.
Oh, wow.
So when she goes through that glass window,
that was a stunt person.
It was indeed. And it actually bothered Cindy a bit because the way she went through the window, her legs are splayed open and she's on her back. Great. This is what I've got to end up doing. My position. Thanks a lot.
That's funny. Yeah. You know, Lyman Ward says probably one of my favorite lines in like any movie ever, which is in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. When he like wiggles his eyebrows at Steve Martin, he's like, "You'll never make the six."
Yes, I forgot all about him being in there.
Got a nice little role in that too.
Yeah.
Tell me about Glenn Shaddix.
Glenn Shaddix, of course, was in Beetlejuice.
Yep.
He was terrific, really great to work with. You know, you try and fill the roles with colorful players. When you've got smaller parts, you want them all to mean something, and you want them all to pop, and you want them all to be portrayed by somebody who doesn't look like everybody else in the show.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of, you know, because of his homosexuality, he was a little nervous about the implications of how the teacher was played as kind of predatory and the like, and he wanted to make sure. So we talked through a lot of that stuff to make sure he was comfortable with all of that. And so he was, and was incredibly, incredibly cooperative and funny. You know, when he loses his hand and is chased, "I'm sorry," running.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. There was a scene where he was in, his body was in the tree and the rope broke and he actually fell. He didn't hurt himself, but he could have. And it was, you know, it's one of those things where whenever you're doing a stunt, my heart is always in my throat until I'm positive we've got it and it's done.
Yeah.
It was one of those things that could have gone so wrong, but thank goodness he was just fine.
Thank God he didn't. And he's so memorable in the movie and so much fun coming right off of Beetlejuice too. So,
yeah, it was really great. I mean, that the whole impetus was having just seen him in Beetlejuice.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan Martin.
Ah, the great Dan Martin. Again, a wonderful actor. And I've used him, I think, four times now, most recently in Nightmare Cinema as the Doctor.
He's great in that too.
Just wonderful. There's just this kind of real feeling to him. You get a sense that he's this character before the movie started and after it ends. You know, he has a sense of veracity. He plays everything so real. And he's so likable, and singing the song to, you know, "Here Comes Johnny with His Pecker in His Hand," all that stuff.
Well, Rebecca had a question about that, which was, did he come up with those or were those in the script?
Actually, it was written in the script and I didn't know, but it was a country western hit.
Huh.
It was a real song. And I thought King had just made it up, you know, and doing his, but my brother Donald had said, "Oh no, I know what that is." And he got the song so we could get all the lyrics and everything. But so the unlikelihood of this terrific African-American lawman in Middle America singing this country western goober song, you know,
was
just so much fun. And he just did such a great job. And he got along so well with Sparks the cat. You know, "Get the bad guy, get the bad guy."
Bad guy, Clovis.
And that you can even hear in the police station, he goes over to pet Clovis because he talks about Clovis being able to see the sleepwalkers when he couldn't. And you hear Clovis purring. That's the real Clovis purr. We didn't dub that in.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool. All right, last but not least, Ron Perlman.
Yeah. Ron was great. I've been a fan of his since I saw Quest for Fire, which he was incredible in. And of course, he had done Beauty and the Beast, for a long time. And but he's a great guy, a great actor. And again, nobody looks like Ron Perlman.
Yeah, it's true.
And don't expect that he's also really funny. And he was able to bring this character into a bigger than life frame. And obviously we had fun together because we worked on Desperation. We did Masters of Horror. And he's another guy that you want to be one of your regulars if you can get him. Yeah.
And a great regular to have in your stable. So you mentioned already that the cold open was a reshoot. What was the impetus for reshooting the Bodega Bay sequence?
Well, to add that sequence, because it started originally with the cats outside the house and then cutting inside, literally cutting inside when Brian Krause is carving Tanya's initial into his arm. That was originally the opening of the movie. And the studio felt that it needed to have a sense of mystery set up before that, that had to do something shocking. And King came up with the idea of all of these hanging cats hanging from the trees. And since we were doing that, they wanted a stronger ending than what had been done. Ended with everything that happened in the house before everything happens outside with the picket fence and the car not working and all of the sleepwalker mom bursting into flames. None of that was in it. And they wanted a new ending. And I said, look, if we're going to do a new ending, would you let me add something to the beginning? Because I feel like it's missing something.
Yeah.
I suggested this scene and King wrote this scene. And so that was how that came to be. And then getting Mark Hamill for that.
It's pretty cool. And I assume that was shot in the Malibu-ish area.
It was definitely shot in the Malibu-ish area. Yeah. And of course, Bodega Bay is the location of the birds.
That's right. That
King
is right.
King had written that into it as a little tribute to Hitchcock.
That is a pretty fun little tribute. And then, of course, we went cross country to Travis, Indiana, which was basically the other side of Los Angeles.
Yes. And of course, Indiana doesn't have the hills of California.
Yeah, the mountains of the flat Indiana. Yeah. Yep. You know what? But if you don't know, it works.
Yeah. And it's Travis, Indiana. That's in the very rare hilly area of Indiana.
That's right. That's right. Of course. Jamie asks, this is a good question because it's so central to the movie. If the rights to the song Sleepwalk had not been available, was there an alternate music piece on hold that had been cleared?
There wasn't an alternate music piece, but Santo and Johnny could not have been happier than to have their song be represented by Sleepwalkers and the title based on their song. And it's such a haunting instrumental that they came up with, this guitar duo.
Yeah,
they were thrilled. I've never met them, but all intelligence was that they were thrilled to have their song be revived again and put back into the public consciousness, because it had been done, I think, in the late 50s or early 60s. And so it worked so well, both as far as the title goes, but also just the track itself is so perfect for putting us ill at ease in that scene. Yes. Where we meet the handsome jockish looking character of Charles Brady, and then he's carving Tanya's initial into his bicep.
Oh, and let alone meeting his mother shortly thereafter.
And all the cats.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's a haunting melody, and one that I think is almost as important as a needle drop we will discuss a little bit later.
Yeah.
But speaking of needle drops, one of my favorite scenes in this movie and in probably any of your movies is Tanya's introduction, dancing at the Arrow movie theater, which you know, I saw in Sleepwalkers before actually gracing the halls of myself, which was pretty cool. So tell me about it. Walk me through making that scene. And was Do You Love Me a needle drop that was referenced in the script? How did that come to be?
There was no musical number in the script. It was something, it was like, you know, let's really have fun with introducing Tanya and the movie theater. We're about to have them meet each other in a meet cute with spilled popcorn.
Yep.
But I just had the idea that she's got a Walkman clipped onto her belt as she's doing the carpet sweeper. And originally, that whole sequence was shot with one Steadicam shot. The crane starts on the top of the marquee. It comes down. The Steadicam operator steps off of the crane and wow. into the theater, and then finds Tanya and then dances with her. And then we decided, you know, to really amplify the fun that she's having, to cut some coverage into it as well. But it was kind of one of the first musical numbers I'd ever done. And it was simple, but sweet and effective. And then it leads to the jolt of her beating of her meeting Brian.
Which is a good jump scare in and of itself. So when you did it as one take, did you shoot the coverage then and there, or was that something you found in the edit, like kind of cutting up the?
No, I decided, you know, this is a little chancy. We'd better shoot the coverage just in case, as I did at the end of shooting the scene in front of the mirror.
Right. And which was smart instincts in both cases. And was she actually dancing to Do You Love Me in the earphones or yep, that was.
It was not in the earphones. We were playing it back because there's no dialogue in the scene.
Right.
Until it ends.
Got it. So it wasn't a needle drop down in post. It was planned for that. She
was dancing too.
Yeah, that's great. Did she prep the dance with anyone, or was that something she came up with on her own?
Well, she knew what I was planning on doing, but we had not rehearsed it until we got to the set that day. Right. So she's a great dancer.
Yeah.
So I had no qualms about just her vamping it.
Nice. That's great. That's really cool. But it wasn't all location work on this movie. You shot several scenes on the studio lot.
Yeah. Well, the interiors of the Brady house and some of the exterior, where the car crashes through the wall, and various other things were shot on the soundstage, but primarily the Brady house.
Well, tell me about some of your neighbors on the soundstage.
Oh, well, there were three feature films being shot at the same time.
Yeah.
Hook by Steven Spielberg, Bram Stoker's Dracula by Francis Coppola, and Stephen King's Sleepwalkers by Mick Garris. What's wrong with this picture? Yeah, I mean, a couple of the gods and then a gremlin. Yeah.
but I mean, what great company to be in. And speaking of having that neighbor, someone popped by at one point, right?
Yeah, I was shooting the dancing scene where Charles is kind of reanimated from his death throes to dance with Tanya. And Steven Spielberg came over from his set and he just wanted to watch. And I said, did you want to talk or something? No, I just want to watch. And okay. And so it was a little unnerving, but I knew I had my job to do. And we were shooting at some pretty interesting little techniques and the like I had put both the monster sleepwalker on the dolly with the camera. So the moves were happening with the character, and the same thing with Tanya as they're both looking into the camera lens and doing some fun little cinematic tricks and transformation stuff was going on and all of that. And Steven was just watching quietly. And can we get you something? No, I just want to watch. And he hung out for like 2 hours while we're doing this stuff. And so later on, I found out that, when the film was finished, and we'll get into that later too, he asked me to bring it over to his house and show it to him. And what I found out was that he was going to offer me Plastic Man to direct, which never got made. And, it, you know, he did ask me to do it, and then the film never happened. So, well.
Wow. So he was scouting, and also I think he just loves being around movies being made, you know?
Well, he was also proud that he was the guy who launched my career. He gave That's me true. My
first, Yeah. And now he's watching you direct on a studio lot.
So. Yeah. Next to his stage. And it Pretty was, cool. It was pretty great. And he really was, it just gave me a lot of confidence. And he was really proud to see me doing that work and made it clear that he felt personal about it.
Well, one last Spielberg question. William asks, is it true that Steven Spielberg helped set up a shot in the movie?
No.
No. All right. There you go.
That puts that down.
Another rumor squashed.
Yeah, I wish he had. I would have used it.
Well, one of the most famous sequences in the movie is obviously the car chase with Brian Krause and Dan Martin.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. So, and as far as I know, that was probably like your first big car chase that you directed.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, we had one of the great second unit directors on board, Mickey Moore, who did all of the Indiana Jones movies.
Oh, wow.
But he had a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
Before he started shooting.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
And so Bert Dunk, his director of photography, did a lot of the chase scene. And I realized this isn't really working with the energy of it. And so I personally, I'm not an action director. I'm not a second unit director, but I ended up reshooting most of the chase scene myself, which is not to pat myself on the back, but it needed to be done. And it was earn while you learn doing second unit, because, you know, mounting, you learn that if you put something between you and the car, like fences going by or something, it seems faster. You use a wide lens down on the wheel lock to the car. You know, you really get a sense of speed and anxiety and
yeah. Just
ways to use those lenses and camera positions and all of the movement and everything to give it a real sense of purpose and propulsion. Yeah.
When did you know that the footage you were getting from the second unit wasn't up to your snuff? Like when,
up
like
to Mickey Moore's stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
We started getting stuff and it just was a little on the bland side. You know, Bert is a DP. Or right. YCP, not a second unit director, but he a talented right. guy. And working with Mickey, you can't help but learn from the best.
Sure.
But the stuff just didn't feel like it had any speed to it. And I started realizing things like, you know, put the camera on a dolly between the highway and the white picket fence. And when you pass those slats of the fence, you're going to feel
super fast. Yeah.
The speed of the motion amplified and things like that. And I wanted to really use wide lenses on facing the cars and mounts on the cars and things like that, that seemed to amplify the energy that we were going for. Plus getting a piece of original music from Nicholas Pike with screaming guitars and
yeah,
it really helped a lot.
It's a super fun sequence. What did you think when you saw the Pontiac Firebird Trans Am show up in the new iteration of it all those years later?
It's pretty great. I mean, when we had bows to our shining in Dr. Sleep and yep. having iconic iconography from Sleepwalkers show up in it, whenever somebody taps you on the shoulder with something you've done in the past, you know, it's an honor and lots of fun.
I thought it was very cool myself when I saw it. Yeah. Okay. So the other big thing that happens in the car chase, obviously, is we see the first Sleepwalker's transformation.
Right.
So at the time, that kind of metamorphosis technology was pretty cutting edge stuff.
We were the second Morph movie after Terminator 2. With Water Weenie. So it was still brand new. We used a company called PDI, mm-hmm. and they had done the black and white video that John Landis did with Michael Jackson with all the right. person to person. So they were great. All of us were learning about it. Plus, in those days, they were still doing motion control. Motion control is the most tedious, time-consuming, hideous thing. It's what you have to do is set up your tracks and your dollies and figure out your moves, and you make a move and it's programmed into the computer, a dolly move, and then you repeat the move with that same program thing and just setting it up and locking the track into place. If they give you a time of 2 hours, double it and then quadruple it again. That much longer. So, you know, we have a morph that takes place on a camera push-in, just took hours and hours and hours. But that scene in the car, well, Jeff Oaken was our visual effects supervisor and a really
came to the rescue in Nightmare Cinema too.
Did indeed. And just a great guy and a great artist and really knows how to make it happen. And he's done huge movies and he's helped us on smaller things. But so we were still figuring out what you could do with it. And it looks kind of cheesy now in the car scene because it goes through rubber face to little boy face and all. But at the time in 1992, in the theater, when that happened, nobody had ever seen anything like that before. And it was people were laughing. I mean, yeah. But they were laughing with joy,
right?
This outrageousness and these faces we just kind of randomly threw together. And the cute little blonde boy is Jeff Oaken's baby boy at the time.
Oh, is that true? Oh, that's so funny. was it a little nerve wracking, like shooting something that you really didn't know how it was going to turn out? Or like, I mean,
I put my trust in the people.
Yeah.
That I work with. And, you know, Jeff earned my trust early on and we became good friends and the guy is just the best at what he does. And I saw what they were doing. You know, they were showing me sample reels of what you could do.
Okay.
With computer generated imagery and the whole idea of morphing, it may have been brand new, but it had already been vetted out on Terminator.
Right, these other and the Michael Jackson video. Yeah. Right. Well, since we're talking about shape shifting and monsters and such, let's talk about the practical effects makeup.
Yeah,
that was Tony Gardner, right?
It was Tony Gardner. Tony and I had worked together on Psycho 4 before that, and Tony had been part of Rick Baker's Thriller crew, and that's where I met him. I met all of the makeup effects guys at the time when we were working on Thriller. So Tony had his crew, you know, the designs, we went through lots of designs and maquettes and sculptings and all these things until we agreed on that. Now, to me, there's one shortcoming and it's the size of the heads. And the reason is they had to put mechanics in there to be able to make the facial moves, to make the eyebrows, the eyes,
and
all ears work, facial movement. Because that was something we weren't ready to use CGI effects to make that happen. That it would have been, every shot would have been outrageously expensive if we could even figure out how to do it. But so we had actors in those suits, not the, you know, Brian had a partial makeup done to him, but actually when it's the Brian sleepwalker being chasing Glenn Shaddix through the woods and the brook there, it's really Nuno Orsatti Jr., the makeup of, or the stunt supervisor's son, Nuno Orsatti, who looked close enough that if you put the partial face prosthetic on him, we'd get away with that being Brian. But it wasn't Brian. Brian morphed into Noon. So,
tricks of the trade.
Yeah.
All right. Clovis the Attack Cat.
Good old Clovis.
He's a fan favorite. Lots of people want to know what was it like working with him? What was it like working with 126 cats? Is that what you said?
126, yeah.
And how, Patrick specifically wants to know, how did you get them so close to those bear traps and make it so realistic?
Well, first of all, Clovis was 9 cats. We'd cast 9 cats, you know, one to be a hissing mean Clovis, one to be cuddly, one to be, you know, to do all these different specifics. However, Sparks the cat was in every Clovis shot except 2. The 2 hissing shots were another cat. So there were 7 Clovises who never worked, who just stayed in their trailer all day watching cartoons.
Cat videos.
Yeah. But that cat was so talented and so well-trained and so good. And as far as the cats in the front yard of the Brady house, first in the nighttime scene where they're on the roof and all over in the beginning of the movie, and then later on when the trap snaps, all of them had little harnesses. They were trained to wear little harnesses that were pinned into the lawn.
Wow.
So there's 126 cats who, because of their fur, you can't tell, have a little harness on them. And, you know, they would be fed between takes and taken care of and all that. But when you see a bear trap snap shut and you hear that loud clank, that sound makes a lot of what's going on in your head.
Sure.
Those were gentle little spring-driven prop traps that could not have hurt anybody. So when that snap happens, it did scare the cat and he jumped.
Right.
But there was no chance it was going to hurt them.
Well, there you go. That's how it was done. And you said there was a producer or a second unit director who did a lot of the work with the cats, yeah. If I remember correctly.
Dick Stenta, who I mentioned earlier, he did a lot of the second unit work with the cats running through the town and things like that. So otherwise we'd still be shooting.
Yeah.
that was all done on the Warner Brothers lot. And well, part of it was at Sony, but the backlot stuff was on the Warner Brothers lot. And after that movie, there are still feral cats who are generations from the original
Sleepwalkers
that they still have all these cats that live under the sets and,
oh my gosh,
all over the studio lot. So sorry.
the true legacy of Sleepwalkers.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of other things that are tough to direct, I mean, love scenes are notoriously kind of awkward and strange and weird. And you have the added weirdness of the incestual elements to deal with, too. How did you walk Brian and Alice through shooting those sequences?
Well, I made sure that they were comfortable and felt safe and that there was nothing I was going to do that they didn't know about. And, you know, they were fully nude when that was shot because it was important to do that. The whole intent was to shoot it in one moving, unbroken shot where you start at the mirror and the dresser and you drop down to the floor and you see the puddle of clothing there. You go up the bedpost to see the feet of a couple making love, or in this case, just having procreative sex. And then move up the length of their bodies and then slowly reveal their real look in the mirror behind them.
Right.
But because of the movement, because it was a horror film, the ratings board gave it an NC-17. But just to make sure that I was covered, just like in the dance scene, I shot an overhead shot looking down on Alice's face and a tighter shot, two shot of them that we could cut away. But the movement of his butt going up and down was way too much for the pearl clutchers at the MPA.
So the reveal in the mirror, how was that shot?
It was really fun. I had done this trick on my Freddy's Nightmare episode where there's a woman in front of a mirror seeing her reflection. She drops something, she dips down, she comes back up. And during that dip down, the camera goes down with her. We pulled out the mirror and there was a reverse room on the other side of the wall. And so we put a character in makeup there who rose up with her. And as the camera rose up, the two of them, who look completely different from one another now, it was this great little sleight of hand kind of Houdini trick. So in this case, we didn't have to swap anything out because it was all slowly revealed. But as the camera moves into place, on the other side of the wall, we had built a reverse bedroom where everything was the reverse of that. And there's no glass in the mirror. It's just open. Well, there may have been a piece of glass so that we got a little bit of reflection kick.
Right.
But there was nothing there, really. There was no mirror there.
Right.
So it was a theatrical sleight of hand trick.
That is a very cool trick, and I am really glad I asked that question. all right, there is a really
to just go a little more deeply into it. The two makeup covered actors who were aping it were watching a little TV monitor showing them what Brian and Alice were doing,
so that they could mirror it perfectly. That's great. Oh, that's that to me is like. That shows you all of the different departments working together, coming together in one big shot. Yeah, that's cinema, Mick.
Yeah, true.
Okay, I just want to put down a weird rumor that's on IMDb. Let's kill it. Let's nip it in the bud. There is no
It's true.
I mean, I don't think there is. There is no truth to the fact that Brian and Alice were actually having sex while making this movie.
Absolutely not.
Yep, that's what I thought.
Never happened.
Good. Okay, I had a feeling. So hopefully that can be
stricken. So did they.
The IMDb record. Yeah, sure. All right, one last thing about production, and it's one of the things that I think actually has been most iconic, most recently turned you into an action figure for, and that is all the cameos in this movie. There are some great cameos in this movie. Yeah. Stephen King, Clive Barker, Toby Hooper, John Landis, Joe Dante, your wife, Cynthia. How really did you know I'm going to stick all my friends in this movie? And what's the conversation like getting them to do it?
Well, I knew that King was going to visit the set one day. And I came up with the idea of putting him into it. And I asked him, do you want to write? I think the caretaker in the cemetery was in the script, but I thought I'm going to build this. Clive Barker and I became friends right after he came to LA for the first time. And we were represented by the same agency that represented King, CAA, at that time. And Toby Hooper was a really good friend. And Landis and I have been friends since 77. And Joe Dante, of course, I knew from The Howling and beyond. And the idea of taking a Stephen King movie. And Toby Hooper had made The Mangler by this point, based on a Stephen King story. And Clive Barker's career in this country was made by Stephen King putting a blurb on the Books of Blood saying, I've seen the future of horror, and his name is Clive Barker.
Yep.
They had never met. So here's an opportunity to get all three of these guys, not only in one scene, but they're in one shot. It's a moving shot that starts with King, it comes to Barker, it goes to Toby, and then it goes to the car where Machen is a victim of this brutal attack. Well, that shot, you could cut it and lose it and not have any effect on the movie whatsoever. But I knew that the fans would have a great time with it, as I did. Yeah. And in fact, when I saw it on opening night at the Chinese Theater, a full house of 1,200 people hooting and hollering, when that scene came on, you hear, wait, is that Stephen King? Is that Toby Hooper? Many people said, is that Clive Barker? But a couple of did.
And with time, they would come to know.
Exactly. But it was just a little treat for us. And asking directors to act in a movie if it's not challenging is always fun, because everybody wants to do that, and directors don't work together,
right?
This is an opportunity to be on the same set with friends and be able to bring a little camaraderie to it, keep the atmosphere on the set collegial and enjoyable, and you know, we're all in this like making a party together, you know. Under the best possible enthusiastic circumstances.
No, it's super fun, and both scenes with all the cameos are really fun, and they help I think bolster the legacy of Sleepwalkers over these last 30 years.
Yeah.
So
something had to.
I think there's a little bit more than that, but post-production. Yeah. This was your second collaboration with Nicholas Pike.
It was. Yeah.
Tell me about the approach to the score, because, you know, we talked about it is another kind of Norman Rockwell goes to hell story. So how did you and he decide you wanted to differentiate it from what you did before with Critters 2?
Well, this was much more mysterious and much less playful than Critters 2 was, which Critters 2, even though we didn't do trombone jokey comedy music for that, it was still a 40-piece orchestra. This was something that had to convey a sense of dread and a sense of menace and a sense of alienness to it, not outer space alien, but otherness. And the whole idea of this being small town middle America, again, Norman Rockwell goes to hell. There's no greater musical example, composer who fits that than Aaron Copland. And so although he doesn't take any of Copland's themes, it has a lot of the feeling of Copland. It's orchestral, it's traditional sounding, and yet it's in a darker key. It's in a minor key. And in this case, we were recording it on the Sony soundstage with a 60-piece orchestra, and Nicholas was conducting. And what was great was all of the players, normally they just come in and they play and they get paid and they leave. In this case, all of them are looking at the screen while they're playing this really wonderful music going, what is this movie? Because they're used to doing the standard kind of studio movie thing. And
sure.
Here's this music that has all of the cred of a brilliant composer and the scope and range of a big studio movie, but it's this little Stephen King movie that could. And it really enhances the film. It adds weight that it would otherwise not have. A musical score is so much more important than people imagine. It's a huge part of it, as is the whole sound design, as we've talked about before. And so here's a 60-piece orchestra where all of the musicians within the orchestra were really impressed themselves and happy to be a part of it and couldn't believe some of the scenes that they were accompanying.
Speaking of scenes that are unbelievable, obviously we talked about it already. You had to make some cuts to get it down from an NC-17 to an R. But yeah. Gary asks, is there anything that you missed that was cut out?
Well, I would love to have had that shot, just one shot, without it being interrupted. Right. Although we do get a more intimate look at Alice's face during the process, which is a positive that came out of it. But it went back to the MPAA 5 times before we got an R rating.
Wow.
You know, right before the pencil in the ear, when Dan Martin gets gut shot, we had to cut away from the gut shot because, you know, it had the explosive squibs. And you see that in every movie.
Every movie.
And every action movie, whatever. But because it was a Stephen King horror movie, they had their knives out for us.
Oh, man.
And they're just a bunch of things like that. I mean, the movie is what it is. And after 30 years, I don't go back and go, gosh, I wish we could have had those splats when.
Sure. Yeah. And in the moment it's hard, but I think with time it dulls, you know?
And because I was a first time studio filmmaker, the studio wouldn't let me go to the MPAA. The studio rep, I couldn't make my case. They were afraid that I might not be articulate or that I might get angry or be a horror guy, you know? So they wouldn't trust me with going there. So they had a studio representative, which may be why everything
took so long. Yeah.
We went back 5 times, and on the 5th time, they said, if you don't make it this time, it's an NC-17 and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yikes.
But we did. Yes. So.
Good. Well, Charlie writes, what was the story behind using Bodicea by Enya? It's the perfect track.
It is the perfect track, and it's not what we were going to originally use. The music supervisors at Columbia gave me a big bag of CDs to listen to. And it was, you know, I'd first heard Nirvana there, and we were going to use a Nirvana track for the chase scene. But I also knew the guys from Crowded House, and they had done we had used their song in The Stand previous to, well, after this.
Yeah, no, in the future.
Yeah, 2 years later.
Yeah.
But they had a demo that had never been put on one of their albums that would have been a great song for the end of the movie, but the studio didn't want to pay for that.
I should have known it.
But I must say that we found the Enya CD and we found that track, and Nicholas Brown, our editor, cut it into it, and I was immediately convinced, because it really does have that mysterious sense of foreboding and otherworldliness that really works perfectly for the movie.
Yeah, it's very haunting. And honestly, now that you tell me that it was supposed to be a Crowded House track there prior to it, I can see why it spoke to you in a similar way, you know?
Yeah.
It still has that very kind of haunting, melancholy feel, which I think worked perfectly for what it needed to do.
Yeah.
So,
it really became iconic for both the song and the film. Just like Don't Fear the Reaper, it's hard to hear that without thinking of The Stand. It's hard to hear Boadicea without thinking of Sleepwalkers.
Absolutely. All right, Brain Mutant writes, was there ever any plans for a prequel or sequel? It feels like there's still so much potential to explore.
Nobody talked about it at the time. A couple of years later, King's wife, Tabitha, wrote a treatment for a sequel that I never read, but it did deal with a woman's basketball team. So I don't know where that went, but nothing ever came of that. But that was Tabby's idea, and I would love to see what that would have been.
Digging through the Wikipedia page, I also found a talk from our podcast. We were quoted on our podcast, and I'm quoting the Wikipedia page about a quote from our podcast, where we talked about a meeting we had it was probably 2019 at this point, with a production company about doing a TV series spinoff.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing was, and I was like, God, this does sound like me. It was like Joe Russo said, it was flirting, and that's all it ever was just flirting. And I was like, that does sound like something I would say.
Flirting with disaster. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, but you know, you never know when something will bubble up, but I really, truly, I think the reason it wasn't a lack of interest on their part or our part to try and find a way to do more Sleepwalkers. It's the rights are pretty messy.
The rights are incredibly complicated. You know, there were independent movie makers who were involved, one of whom went to prison for a while on a tax fraud scheme after this happened. You know, the rights were complicated because it was made independently, but in conjunction with Columbia. So Columbia partnered with them. They didn't just pick it up, but they partnered with them. So the rights issue is incredibly complicated. And I assume that could be worked out, but who knows?
Yeah, it was, I think it was a little bit more ambitious than the production company had initially hoped it would be.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, so finally, last and certainly but not least, Casey asks, how have you seen fans' perception of the film change over the past 30 years?
Well, like a lot of the things I've done that didn't do well originally, it seems to have grown on people. However, this one, I need to remind myself that this was the number one movie the week that it came out.
Incredible.
So Sleepwalkers was, you know, the mother and son sex cat monsters was the number one movie in America. And because it had Stephen King's name in the title, they had to say directed by Mick Garris in all of the advertising. So for 1 week, NRG, the research, National Research Group, said that I was the most famous director in America for 1 week because all of the ads said Stephen King's Sleepwalkers, directed by Mick Garris. But it's 30 years old now, and it keeps playing. In 2 weeks, I'm going to Kansas City to do a 30-year anniversary screening there. It plays in festivals all the time. The stars are always told how it's one of their favorite things they've ever done. Machen and Brian and Alice have all said that if they were to go to a festival or a convention or something, everybody wants to talk about Sleepwalkers.
Yeah.
And it's such an odd film that it really has kind of kept its sense of notoriety, which is kind of nice. But it has a staying power that, you know, it's got the special edition from Scream Factory and you know, the people take it to heart. But that's one of the great things about horror fans is they want to own their movies. They want to feel like they're a part of it. And, you know, it's a personal thing that no other genre seems to have. The horror fans really are bonded together in owning and trading and finding the best editions of all of these movies and the like. And it's a really special place to be.
And I hope that this podcast, this 30th anniversary Sleepwalkers Ask Mick Anything, is just one of those things that fans can own even more about a very special movie made by a very special guy. So,
well, thank you, everybody. And thank you, Joe, for ring mastering this whole conversation.
It was my pleasure, Mick. And we will be back with some normal AMAs very soon. We might do some more special ones down the road, but for future, you can send your questions to Mick at Mick Garris PM on Twitter and Instagram, or you can send them to me at Joe Russo Tweets or at Joe Russo Graham on Twitter and Instagram, respectively.
And it would be really helpful if you are enjoying the show that you rate and review Postmortem with Mick Garris on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume your podcasts.
All right, Mick, thank you so much, and happy 30th anniversary to Sleepwalkers.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.